It was a crisp January morning in Boston, 1919. The city awoke to the smell of sweetness in the air. There was a new, large, tall, steel tank full of molasses, thick, rich molasses. It was a symbol of progress, a moneymaker. They used the molasses at that time in making munitions. For a while, they made munitions to supply allies in World War I so that the United States didn't have to enter the war. And then once it entered, they were supplying munitions for the United States government. This was something the city was proud of. But no one knew the danger that was building it within. The steel was too thin. The seams had been rushed. People had even reported leaks, but they'd been painted over rather than being fixed. 12:40 in the afternoon, it happened. A sound like a gunfire split the air. The rivets shooting out of the tank, then a deafening roar. 26 million pounds of molasses burst free, forming a wall of sticky brown liquid 25 feet high. It barreled through the streets at 35 miles an hour, sweeping away horses, wagons, buildings. 21 people died. A city's pride became its tragedy, all because they did what was a good idea, but they ignored the warnings and failed to seek out the right way to accomplish the task. There's a lesson for us today from this century-old molasses disaster. This morning, I want to look at some biblical examples where men did what was a good idea and see how that turned out for them. And then I want to look at some passages which give us advice as to how we should act in situations like this. Let's start with the book of Judges. You remember the story of Gideon. Or the story of the Israelites throughout the Judges was there's a cycle there where Israel would turn its back on God. It would forget God. It would rely upon itself. And that's what was happening at this particular point in time. I'm going to give you verse references here, but that's chapter 6 and verse 1. And as a result of that, the nation of Midian had oppressed Israel for 7 years. Eventually, when Israel cried out to the Lord, he raised up Gideon as a judge, chapter 6 and verse 14. You remember the story of how God winnowed the army down. He didn't want Israel to have a mighty army so that they would be relying on themselves. They would think how great their victory was. He winnowed it down to where Gideon only had 300 men to go into battle. Judges chapter 7, verse 2. Yet they claimed a victory over Midian because God was with them. Now, the nation of Israel told Gideon they were willing to make him and his descendants their king. Chapter 8, verse 22. But rather than accepting the kingship, Gideon said, "No, you've taken all of this plunder, this spoil from these people. You have all of this gold. Each person give me an earring from your spoil." And what he did was he took those earrings and he fashioned an ephod. Now, an ephod was the priestly garment, like a vest that the priest would wear that would signify their role in their relationship with God. And he displayed this ephod of gold that he made in Ophrah, which was his hometown. And that's chapter 8, verses 24 through 27. Gideon appeared to be thinking, what better way for Israel to remember and trust in God than to have this priestly ephod displayed, which is made from their spoils of victory? What do you think? Good idea? Seems like it. That was the problem. They kept forgetting about what God did for them. He says, I've got a way to help them remember what God has done for them. Okay, let's set that one aside. Saul, in 1 Samuel 13, he had become the king, and he was going up against the Philistines at Michmash with 2,000 men. We read about this in 1 Samuel 13, beginning in verse 2. Now, when we start to see how big that Philistine army was, in verse 5, it says the Philistines had 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sand on the seashore. The Israelites were outnumbered. Now, when they saw how many Philistines there were, they were scared. Some hid, some ran away. Verses 6 and 7. Saul, as he had agreed with Samuel, waited 7 days for Samuel to show up so that Samuel could come and offer the sacrifice to God before they went into battle. 7 days were up, and Samuel didn't show up. And the army was starting to scatter. Vastly outnumbered, Saul knew that if he waited any longer, if any more of his army departed, it was going to be almost impossible to defeat the Philistines. So Saul, knowing that he could not go into battle without first sacrificing to God, called for the sacrifice to be brought, and he, King Saul, made the burnt offering to God before he went into battle. Seems like a good idea. What do you think? You know, is that, wouldn't you want to make sure that you make the sacrifice to God before you go into battle? Let's hold on to that. That was in verse 9. Let's go to the New Testament. John chapter 18. In the first 11 verses of John 18, we read about how Jesus and his disciples were gathered in the Garden of Gethsemane. Verse 1. While they were there, Judas came to betray Jesus. He came with Roman soldiers, servants from the chief priest, from the Pharisees. Verse 3. They made it clear their intention was to seize Jesus, to arrest Jesus, to try Jesus. Peter, ever impulsive, violently reacted in an apparent effort to keep them from arresting Jesus. Peter draws his sword and cuts off the ear of Malchus, the high priest's slave. Verse 10. If you were there, if you were in the presence of Jesus and you see these people coming, intent to seize him, intent to carry him away, what would you do? What would you do to protect Jesus? Is it a good idea to stand up and try and protect Jesus? As we look at each of these examples, and frankly, there are many more as we look through the Bible and we see what people did and we put ourselves in that situation and we say, I see why they're doing that. That's a good idea. There is some right thinking going on here. But then we need to look at the rest of the story. With Gideon, remember, he made the ephod from the treasures of war with the idea that Israel would remember God's help. But in Judges 8 and verse 27, all Israel played the harlot with it, meaning the ephod, there, so that it became a snare to Gideon and his household. The very thing that he was trying to accomplish, it was the exact opposite result. Verses 33 through 35 of Judges 8. Then it came about as soon as Gideon was dead that the sons of Israel again played the harlots with the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. Thus the sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, that is, Gideon, in accord with all the good that he had done to Israel. He had a good idea, but his idea didn't accomplish what he intended it to be. It seemed like making an ephod would be a good idea to Gideon, but God didn't tell him to do that. It was Gideon's idea, not God's idea. He likely had the best of intentions in helping the Israelites to remember. Get the Israelites out of this cycle of leaving God and coming back to God and leaving God and coming back. He said, I'll break the cycle. I'll help them to remember. Best of intentions. But it ended up being just another idol. And it pulled the people away from God. And when Gideon died, they went straight back to the Baal idols. The cycle continued. So we look at Saul and remembering Saul. He's out there ready to go into battle, and he offers the burnt offering. He offers the sacrifice to God before going into battle. What happens next? Of course, Samuel shows up just as soon as the sacrifice is offered. This 1 Samuel 13:13, Samuel says, you have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God. Samuel told him exactly how it was. You thought this was a good idea for you to go up and do this, but that's not what God told you to do. It seemed like a good idea. It could seem like a good idea to us, but it's not what God said to do. And as a result, not only was Saul rebuked by Samuel, but he had consequences from God too. In 1 Samuel 13:14, but now your kingdom, Saul's kingdom, shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over the people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. Of course, referring to David. This was the incident when Saul says, I want to offer a sacrifice to God before I go into battle. And God says, you're not going to be king. I'm going to make David king. Not because you followed what was a good idea in your sight, but because you didn't listen to me. You didn't follow what I told you to do. He's not saying that offering the sacrifice was a bad idea. In fact, that was the plan. The plan was for Samuel to come and offer it. But the bad idea was for him to not do it the way God had said to do it. We look at Peter, how he violently jumped in to defend Jesus from being arrested. He'd been with Jesus for 3 years. He knew the power of Jesus. He had relied upon, trusted in Jesus. He wrapped up his life in Jesus. He saw these people coming to take. He's heard Jesus talk about the dangers that he's facing, what's going to befall him. And he was seized at the moment to try and step in and defend and stop this from happening. It seemed like a good idea to Peter. But Jesus says to Peter, put the sword in its sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it? It seemed to Peter like he needed to take any measure he could to try and protect Jesus, even violence. But what Peter didn't understand was that God had a plan. He didn't understand what that plan was. Jesus rebukes him. Jesus heals Malchus's ear. And then Jesus very pointedly shows how Peter's well-intended action was actually a sign that Peter didn't understand and that Peter didn't actually trust Jesus. Jesus being seized by the crowd, Jesus being crucified was part of God's plan. Rather than having Peter stand up and say, I won't let this happen, Jesus says, it's God's plan that this happen. You need to let this happen. Well, like the massive molasses tank, our best plans are fraught with danger and unintended consequences. The Bible tells us in Proverbs 14:12, and again in chapter 16, verse 24, there is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. This is a little bit difficult. I mean, we read that and we say about that, we talk about that and go, yeah. But when it comes to when we're faced with what should we do, this seems like a good idea. This seems to be what God would like. This seems to be pursuing all of the different things that the ends and the goals that God has been teaching us about. And we rely upon that. We rely upon our experience. We rely upon, frankly, our pride in making good decisions to say, this is a good idea. This seems right. But yet, when we rely upon ourselves, when our way seems like it's right, we have to look and say, that end may have some unintended consequences. The end may be death, particularly if my way is not God's way. If we rely upon our heart, we have to realize that we're relying upon a very deceitful heart. As was just read in Jeremiah 17, verses 5 through 11, but right down there in verse 9 at the end of that, the heart is more deceitful than all else. What do we say? So often we go, led by my heart. My heart tells me to do this. In my heart, I know this is the right thing to do. Every time we say that, and God says, your heart's lying to you. Don't look to your heart as your guide. Back up in verse 5, it starts, cursed is the man who trusts in mankind and makes flesh his strength, and whose heart turns away from the Lord. When we turn to our heart, our deceitful heart, too often we're turning away from God. We tell ourselves, I know what God says, I've studied that, so I'm gonna do this. Rather than saying, what should we do? Let's see what God says. Let's study what God says. Let's find out what God is saying, rather than going, I'll use all that as background, and then I have a good idea. Then I have something. When we're doing that, we're turning away from the Lord and turning to our heart, our deceitful heart. We have to understand that we can't rely upon our own barometer of what is right or is a good idea. Frankly, this is a cry for humility. This is a cry for us to recognize that we are not as good as we want to portray ourselves to be, or we want to think ourselves. We're not as right-minded or right-thinking as we pridefully put ourselves out as. We have to recognize that no matter how good we are, no matter how much good we pursue, no matter how much we understand the background of the scriptures, we have to rely upon God, not our own understanding. That's the lesson here. That's the lesson, is that when we start relying upon ourselves and not pursuing what God is saying, what God is teaching us, we're going to end up in the wrong place. We're told that we need to not only trust God, but to seek out God. Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 through 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight. Hebrews chapter 11 and 6, and without faith it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. It's not enough to say, I know who God is, and I'm setting myself up for God based on whatever I already know about God, or what I remember about God, or what I'm thinking about God. I need to seek God. I need to seek God's word. I need to seek God's will. I need to seek God's wisdom and rely upon that. Trust in that. Because if I'm not, I'm pridefully relying upon my own understanding. And I'm destined to be on a road to unintended consequences. They're going to take me away. Our idea, our plan, our method may make a lot of sense and actually be a good idea. But we need to recognize the limitation of our own understanding and search out what the Lord's word, will, and plan is. The reality is that we fail to recognize the hidden dangers in our own ideas. When we come up with something as a good idea, we immediately become blinded to all of the bad things that could come of that. It's hard for us to objectively evaluate our own ideas. We become proponents, pushing those ideas when we propose those ideas. The only way that we can be right, the only way that we can choose right, is when we place our trust in the Lord. So, I talk shorter than Mason too, so I'm going to hold this one up, write it for as long as I can. The point is this: we all need to make a commitment to following God. And oftentimes that requires us to adjust the way that we approach things. Or if we're relying upon our understanding up to this point, our study up to this point, and we don't actively seek out what God says, God looks at that. God's judging us. God's saying, you're choosing your way rather than my way. And we can have all sorts of unintended consequences. What we need to do is make a commitment in our life that we're going to follow God. We're going to trust Him. Now, if you haven't made that commitment, you can make that commitment today. You can make the commitment to say, I will follow Jesus. I acknowledge Jesus as the Son of God. I understand that that's the right path. I'm going to do that rather than my way. I will be baptized, and I will follow in the steps of Jesus. Or, if you started off on that path, and you found that you were not able to maintain it, you find that you have pulled away from God, now is a good time to get back to that. You can come forward. We'll pray with you. We'll pray for you. We can work with you and support you. That is God's plan. That is what God wants to do to help each of us stay on that path. But regardless, if you're here this morning, you're subject to the gospel invitation. We invite you to come as we stand and sing the song selected.